Argument this morning is Riviera Distributors against Jones. Mr. Murphy.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is James Murphy. I represent the appellants, the defendants in the district court, Mr. Tim Jones and Midwest Electronic Specialties. Your Honors, this case began in the district court as a copyright infringement case. This appeal is about abuse of the judicial process, which resulted in the district court denying an award of attorney's fees and sanctions in a case in which there were never any copyrighted works to even adjudicate. The plaintiffs filed a complaint identifying five copyright registrations. Plaintiffs referred to these copyright registrations as the Riviera Merit Code. They asserted that this code was copied and infringed by software code in a game entitled Stars and Stripes belonging to the defendants. Yet one of the copyright registration numbers, as a brief review of the Copyright Office database records showed, corresponded to an advertisement. Plaintiffs never had any factual basis for any of their allegations of copyright infringement in this case. Copyright infringement. Copyright itself subsists in tangible works of authorship, tangible works of expression. To prove copyright infringement, a plaintiff must show that a copyright is valid and that the work was copied. Generally, copying is shown through substantial similarity. This case is so exceptional because the plaintiffs never had possession of any tangible copyrighted work. They merely listed registration numbers in a complaint and alleged infringement. That's not evidence of infringement. In this case, there were never any copyrighted works to be adjudicated. At some point in discovery, plaintiffs admitted to the...
I'm puzzled. You say this many times in your brief, but if I file a lawsuit saying you've infringed my copyright in Gone with the Wind, I don't have to have a physical copy of Gone with the Wind in order to sue you. I only need to own the copyright.
That's correct, Your Honor, except for the fact that to prove a copyright infringement, there has to be proof of copying.
There has to be proof of copying.
That's right.
So presumably somebody has to manage to come up with the original. But I don't have to own it. It could be that you've stolen the original from me, and I might have to get it by subpoena in the litigation.
Theoretically, that's correct, Your Honor. These plaintiffs never had possession of these copyrighted works.
They don't have to have possession. That's the point. And the fact that they don't have possession doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Now, it may be that it doesn't exist or that you didn't infringe it or any of those things, but the proposition plaintiffs don't possess a copy doesn't mean that there is no original or that there can't be copyright litigation.
Yes, Judge, I agree with that. However, these particular plaintiffs never had possession and therefore couldn't have done any sort of analysis.
Completely irrelevant. You concede my point and then come back to make the same error.
I'm not conceding that point, Your Honor. What I'm saying is
these... Of course, irrelevant to your request for attorney's fees, so perhaps you might want to go on.
The point is, Your Honor, when we filed a summary judgment motion indicating that they couldn't possibly prove their case without the copyrighted works to show copying or validity, either required prong of a copyright infringement case. In response to the summary judgment motion, plaintiffs took no steps to correct these frivolous allegations or withdraw the frivolous allegations. What they did is they filed several motions. One was a motion for leave to file an amended complaint, which continued to allege infringement of non-existent works that they had never analyzed or reviewed. Another motion they filed is a motion to compel. They sought our contentions as to why we didn't infringe non-existent works. They also sought to compel our trade secret computer codes.
I wish you'd stop. If you're trying to figure out how to lose this appeal, you're doing very well at it. The fact that the plaintiff does not possess a copy of the work does not mean that the work doesn't exist. And if that's what you think your appeal hinges on, you're a goner.
Judge, what happened here is the plaintiffs acted vexatiously and unreasonably in response to a summary judgment motion indicating that they couldn't prove a copyright infringement case. In response to that, defendants served a Rule 11 motion. Just before the safe harbor period was up, plaintiffs, still not having been able to find or review any of the copyrighted works, the plaintiffs then voluntarily moved to dismiss. The defendants sought their attorney's fees as a condition of dismissal under Rule 41 and fees under 1927, which were denied. Those requests were denied without any explanation whatsoever by the district court. Subsequently,
after the district court violated Circuit Rule 50, why didn't you ask for a remand? Circuit Rule 50 says that violations of that rule should be brought to our attention immediately, right? And the district court is required to give reasons for what it does.
Yes.
So there was a violation of Circuit Rule 50 here. We obviously can't review intelligently the denial of this motion because the judge never explained his reasons, if any.
That's correct, Judge.
But that's supposed to be drawn to our attention without the need for briefs and oral argument.
It was, Judge. I can look in the record.
File a motion under Circuit Rule 50 for a remand?
I'm sorry. No, I didn't. I drew attention to it in the first statement that we filed in the appellate court, whatever that's called, I can't recall. It was stated expressly in a couple of paragraphs that we believe Circuit Rule 50 was violated. We did bring it to the court's attention, maybe not in an appropriate procedural fashion.
Statements made in docketing statements don't come to the attention of a motions panel, so they don't do any good.
I apologize for that, Your Honor. It was my procedural mistake, but it was attempted to be brought to the court's attention. But moving on, Judge, once the district court in this case dismissed the case with prejudice, the defendants became prevailing parties and moved under Section 505 of the Copyright Act for attorney's fees. The Section 505 of the Copyright Act allows prevailing parties attorney fees in the discretion of the court. This court has held that in cases like this, where a defendant prevails in a frivolous case, there's a strong presumptive entitlement to fees. The district court abused its discretion when it denied fees under Section 505 of the Copyright Act. The district court abused its discretion in two ways. It first applied an incorrect legal standard in holding that the defendants were not prevailing parties. Its second, it abused its discretion when it relied on clearly erroneous findings of fact, which were clearly contrary to the record, in attempting to support its denial of fees. First, the district court applied the wrong legal standard when it relied on the National Conference of Bar Examiners case to hold that defendants were not prevailing parties because there was no finding on the merits. That legal ruling was an error and directly in contradiction to this circuit's cases of Phillips, Claiborne, and the Marlowe case cited in our briefs. That alone would require a reversal. The district court also abused its discretion when it relied on clearly erroneous findings of fact in supporting its denial of fees. The district court made statements such as, there has been no evidence of lack of merit to the copyright infringement claims of plaintiffs, and other statements such as, plaintiffs' claims survived a motion to dismiss and made a plausible showing of copyright infringement. Plaintiffs never made any plausible showing of any sort. There was never any works to adjudicate. There were never any works to compare to the accused code, and therefore plaintiffs could not have made any plausible showing of either validity or of substantial similarity.
Mr. Murphy,
yes.
District court here apparently thought that the he had to dismiss with prejudice, and it's not clear to me the reason why. Why he said he couldn't do it without the permission of the other party, but he was rather vague as to why. What's your understanding of why he thought the dismissal had to be with prejudice rather than without?
Well, my understanding, Judge, is that the plaintiffs actually asked for two alternative forms of relief under the Rule 41. They first asked for dismissal without prejudice, and they asked for one of the requests was dismissal with prejudice. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The district court didn't hold any hearings. It didn't have any interaction with the parties. So I don't know why the district court decided to deny with prejudice, other than understanding that because there were no copyrights, maybe that was appropriate. But I don't know why the district court denied with prejudice. I want to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if that's appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy.
Thank you.
Mr. Riffle.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Robert Riffle on behalf of both of the plaintiff appellees in this case. At the heart of this case is really a simple clerical error, and I freely admit that was made by my office, and that's what really started this whole situation. But I want to put that in context. When the original complaint was filed, and I think it's adequately addressed in the brief, the ECF filing was brand new, and inadvertently my office filed the wrong version of a complaint in this case. All along we had intended to include the Americana Code as one of the copyrights or one of the works that were at issue. We still believe to this day all the things that we stated with respect to the infringement, specifically that Americana was the ultimate culmination of all of this development by Merit of these previously copyrighted works, and that indeed the Stars and Stripes game blatantly violates these copyrights. The question came up as to what...
Do you believe that there was infringement? Why didn't you appeal to the expert that was set up by this technical expert under the settlement agreement?
That is exactly the parameters of what we were trying to do in the course of the mediation. And that was all ongoing at the time.
I'm lost. Do you mean you tendered this dispute to the technical expert and to the court at the same time?
No, Your Honor, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. Yeah, there was no effort to go the route of the expert under the...
But that's the biggest puzzle here for me. The parties have a dispute about whether the defendant is infringing Riviera's copyrights.
Yes.
And they sit down and they hammer out an agreement about how that's going to be resolved. And it says this dispute will be submitted to a technical expert who presumably can sit down and compare the source code, which is the right way to do it. And then instead of submitting the dispute to the technical expert, you file this lawsuit. And that makes the lawsuit look rather flimsy, right? You've agreed to a form of arbitration, and then you say, and oh, by the way, foo on that, I'm going to go file a lawsuit anyway.
Yes, it was our understanding, and it was carefully negotiated. It may not be crystal clear in the record or in the agreement itself, but that Stars and Stripes was a whole different situation. There was a material representation that Stars and Stripes did not contain this code, and ultimately it was determined that indeed it did. So, and that was litigated before the district court in the early rounds.
But what does this have to do with my question, which is why you didn't go to the technical expert that the parties had agreed would resolve the question whether their code infringed your rights?
Our intellectual property...
We say pretty frequently that somebody who agrees to arbitrate a question and then files a lawsuit anyway is engaged in frivolous litigation. And that appears to be what you have done.
Your Honor, the analysis was that the Stars and Stripes Code was not within the scope of what the parties had agreed to submit to the neutral party. And I believe that was the subject of early briefing, and the district court ruled that the case could proceed. And I don't believe that was ever...
I looked and could not see any discussion by the district court of this technical expert question. The issue that it looked like the district court was resolving was whether the settlement had extinguished any claim.
Yes.
But that's different from the question whether, if a claim survives, the right person to determine it is the technical expert rather than the court. You don't need a technical expert if all claims have been extinguished. The technical expert is for the non-extinguished claims. Did the district court ever discuss why it was permissible to proceed in court rather than before the technical expert?
I believe so. In the course of the original motions to dismiss, frankly, I don't think any of that was briefed here, and I didn't go back and look at those early pleadings, but I believe that was the subject of briefing early on in the motions to dismiss, and that the court.
Yeah, but do you think the district judge ever mentioned that? Because I couldn't find any discussion of this by the judge. Lack of discussion by the district judge seems to be a theme running through these proceedings.
Yeah, honestly, as I sit here, I can't recall exactly. I do recall that was a issue early on in the case and was resolved in favor of litigation, but I don't recall the court's exact discussion of that, Your Honor. Our firm belief, and we believe we did substantial pre-suit investigation. We talked to the people at Merit who gave us this understanding as to the culmination of the product. We talked to a former Midwest employee who actually observed the creation of Stars and Stripes and observed the process that was followed. And we have the affidavit of somebody who has played both games and has attested to the fact that they have the same look, the same feel, the same bonuses, the same play.
That's completely irrelevant. The copyright question is whether the source code is the same. It's perfectly fine for them to produce the look and feel unless you've patented it.
Right. As to the copyrights, we believe that embedded within the ultimate code, the Americana, is all of this code that has ever been derived essentially by Merit, and that we do indeed have the code that would provide us the opportunity to ultimately prevail. Procedurally, what happened here, we were caught off guard with the filing of the motion for summary judgment. We were in the midst of mediation. All of a sudden, they'd been working for over a month on preparing this summary judgment motion, sprung that on us. At that time, they also filed a Rule 11 motion. Despite the fact that we firmly believe to this day that Stars and Stripes infringes my client's code, we made a decision to avail ourselves of the safe harbor under Rule 11, again, fully believing that we still had meritorious claims, but deciding that that was the prudent thing to do at that time. And we conditioned our motion to dismiss on there being no award of attorney's fees, and the court ruled in our favor in that manner. And so I believe that under Rule 11 it would be really inconsistent with Rule 11 safe harbor for somebody to decide to dismiss a claim even though they still believe it's viable, only to ultimately be sanctioned. So we think that there's the defendant's argument, frankly, would undermine the Rule 11 safe harbor, and also the conditions that we propose with respect to the dismissal were honored by the court, and I think it's clear that if they weren't honored, we would not necessarily be bound by that dismissal. We would have the right, essentially, to reinstate the case because, as the cases indicate, such a dismissal wouldn't be voluntary if conditions are imposed that were not acceptable in the proposed dismissal. As the court has pointed out, whether we have exact copies of those original underlying copyrights at the present time is not dispositive as to whether we can ultimately prove copyright infringement. These games exist out there, the old Joker poker games, the old chicken poker games, they're actually out in commerce.
I'm puzzled by your last argument. Your last argument seems to say that the conditions of dismissal have to be acceptable to the plaintiff. And Rule 41A2 says an action shall not be dismissed at the plaintiff's instance save upon order of the court and upon such terms and conditions as the court deems proper. I don't see in A2 any provision that if you don't like the court's conditions, you get to withdraw the notice of dismissal. Now, maybe there's some case law to that effect. Is there?
There is the case law, Your Honor, and we cite that. Trying to find that in the brief, but there is case law, and we also cite to the treatise. Wright and Miller at page 43, I believe, of our brief. In Miller, again at page 43 of our brief, although the power to set terms and conditions is vested in the court, the plaintiff may move for dismissal on conditions stated in the plaintiff's motion. Under these circumstances, the court either must grant the motion on the conditions offered or deny the motion. Dismissal would not be voluntary if more onerous conditions were imposed. And then Marlowe case, Marlowe versus Winston and Strawn, and the Chavez case that we cite. So we would have been fully content to continue to litigate this case if the conditions we suggested were not acceptable to the court. The court accepted the conditions we proposed, and again, under the circumstances, we still believe we have a meritorious case to impose sanctions on us under the circumstances when we voluntarily dismiss this claim would seem inappropriate to us. And we believe the district court operated properly in making that determination. I want to make just two very quick points, if I may. One, this whole idea of the inadvertent mistake with respect to Americana, defendants knew full well all along in this case.
I think we have your position with respect to that, counsel.
And also,
much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Murphy?
Just briefly
is all you have.
The court asked the question about the district court looking at the issue of the independent expert clause. That was brought up the very first thing in the motion to dismiss raised by defendants, where at the appendix at page 18. This is what we argue. The court does not have subject matter jurisdiction because it's precluded by the party's prior agreement. It was brought up.
Nothing whatsoever to do with subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, the issue was raised, Judge, and I haven't reviewed this. I just reacted to your question, the whole motion. But it was raised that the case should not be in court at all because...
And did the district court ever address that issue?
It did not. It ignored the issue, Judge.
It. Okay.
Pardon me?
Said, I looked to see what the district judge had said about that problem, couldn't find it, and you're saying the judge never did address it.
That's correct. And the plaintiffs here, however, state in their brief, and this is at page 23, their second response brief, the district court, at defendant's insistence, ruled that the claims arising under the code of conduct cannot be pursued in federal court, and it goes on. They provide no cite, which is a theme throughout their briefs, no cites to any record evidence of, or frankly, much of anything.
Okay, thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
The case is taken under advisement.